Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 project here on the Nerd Party, the only podcast that takes you through the back catalogue of A24 films, two films every fortnight, plus interviews with the people behind the movies. On today's episode, we review The Farewell and Midsummer. I'm your co-host Dallas King, and with me as always is the Danny to my Christian, it's Lee Hutchison. How are you?
Yeah, really excited about this double pairing today. It's one of our kind of most exciting pairings, I think. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to diving into it with you.
Absolutely, and I called you Danny and myself Christian there, you know. I always like to take the butt of the joke, but you know, you've got preempted me with a very special, unique piece of artwork, which I think we've shared on the Nerd Party account, which was you commissioned Team Filibuster to be dressed up as members of the Helsingborg sort of Midsummer family, didn't you?
Yeah, I did, yeah. One of my mates is an artist, and I thought, like, I want to get you and Kim a little token of my thanks. So yeah, I thought I would give you the opportunity to be the bear, Kim to be Danny. You know, I didn't want you just to be some generic person in the background. So yeah, I thought you looked pretty good as a bloody bear.
Yeah, no, I think you did. Ah, so Kim's Danny. So I guess that would probably make you Pelle then.
The
puppet master pulling all the strings.
There you go, see?
Cool. So, as always, you know, you're probably still aware we are still in lockdown, so not a huge amount of A24-hour news has been the running theme for the last couple of months, but there's a small couple of nuggets. First one being that the A24 auctions sort of finished last week, and the hottest item turned out to be not the Midsummer Dress, which went for $65,000, and it turned out to have been bought by the Academy, not Ariana Grande. So the Academy are going to have that on display in their museum. But the most sought-after item, which went for, in the end, over $108,000, was the little bone ivory mermaid. So there must have been a lot of people in a bidding war to potentially rub one out Arpat style. Did you place a bid?
I did not, no. I can see why that one would potentially end up. Probably you would say the dress is that a little bit more iconic, and you know, you probably if you had it in your kind of museum or personal room or something like that, people would be like, oh, what's the... Wouldn't perhaps need as much explanation as sort of the model from the lighthouse. But I think with the lighthouse one, I think it almost comes down to the fact that you could easily pick that one up and, you know, put it anywhere in a house, whereas you can imagine there is a lot of upkeep with a big flower dress.
Yeah, no, the dress is rather large, and yeah, you would need almost an entire room to display that one. It's much more handy, you know, it's pocket size, the mermaid, so yeah, it's always good. So with that, the other big news that sort of broke in the past week was the Safdie brothers have signed a first look deal, TV deal, with HBO, with A24 producing behind them. So what did you make of this news? Is it exciting times?
Yeah, I think we've always spoke about that we're potentially going to have to pick up on some of these HBO, A24 TV shows and such like, and maybe one-off movies or whatever that they kind of do. And I think this kind of underlines that we'll have to expand the project. So yeah, I don't want to miss out on any Safdie brothers work. So yeah, they seem to have been really good bedfellows with Good Time and Uncut Gems. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing what kind of work they'll continue to do together. It's been a good, promising partnership so far.
Absolutely, yeah. Both of the Safdie brothers films for A24 are 5 stars from me. I have yet to watch any of the TV programmes, but I think HBO were behind Euphoria and Rami, which I think is just moving on to season 2 in the States just now. I know they do some TV work with Apple as well, so it's sort of split between the two, but HBO certainly pushes the boundaries in terms of its sort of sex, violence, language and stuff like that, so it seems to be a good fit for the Safdie brothers, considering I think I did see a Uncut Gems mini version which was just the swearing, and I think it came in at around about 400 or something. It's probably definitely in the top 10 for the most amount of swear words in any film, so we've got that to look forward to, but on the TV, which is good. But, you know, we're not here to talk about the TV shows yet. We're getting there, because it could be soon to say farewell to the films of A24 until First Cow and St. Maud that get back into the cinemas. But we're going to say hello to the farewell today. with Lulu Wang's The Farewell, which is about a young Chinese-American woman who returns to China when her beloved grandmother is diagnosed with terminal cancer. Billy struggles with the family's decision to keep Grandma in the dark about her own illness as they stage an impromptu wedding to see her one last time. The film was written and directed by Lulu Wang and is based on an actual lie and stars Awkwafina and Shizhen Zhao. It's nominated for Best Film, not in the English language, at the BAFTAs and Golden Globes. Won Best Actress in the Musical or Comedy for Awkwafina at the Golden Globes. Nominated for 0 Oscars, but did get Best Supporting Actress and Best Feature at the real Oscars, the Film Independent Spirit Awards. It's the first ever PG-rated A24 film, currently sitting at 98% on Rotten Tomatoes. And of course, you know, this was one of the films that sort of a huge hit on the festival circuit, such as Sundance London, and the Atlanta Film Festival. And the Nerd Party's very own Sean Eastridge was lucky enough to talk to writer-director Lulu Wang there. So let's hear them chatting about the film.
So this is your second feature,
yes.
Which is super exciting.
Yes.
And what was the journey to get this movie made? Because I know it's a very personal story.
Yeah.
So what was that like trying to pitch that, and were there any struggles getting it to hear it to the big screen?
Yeah, I mean a lot. You know, it's a, I would say, 100% Asian cast. There's a lot of Chinese in it, so there's a lot of subtitles. That was the film that I wanted to make. I wanted to make exactly the movie that you see, and I think that there was a producers who were interested initially, but they wanted a different movie. They wanted a bigger, broader movie, and they may have forced me to cast in a different way, and it took some time before I found the right producers, and it was really because I did A Story for This American Life, and everybody heard it, that I was able to find the right partners.
Nice. And then I guess as far as finding the balance, because it's such a personal story and it sounds really amazing, how do you find the balance of telling a narrative and disconnecting yourself to be objective about the source material and being objective and telling the story as something that can appeal to an audience and trying to put on your director hat and your writer hat as opposed to kind of like, I experienced this, it's emotional to me, but making that broader in terms of appeal?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I never necessarily went about it thinking, how do I make this appeal to people? It was always like, what's the emotional core of every scene, you know? And what is the movie really about? I mean, the movie is about Billy, who wants to have a cathartic goodbye, wants to say goodbye to her grandmother, and usually that means both people know that it's goodbye, but because her grandmother doesn't know, she's not really able to have a proper goodbye. And so then how does she, you know, handle that? Like, how do you say goodbye? And I just kept asking that question as I was directing the film and writing it as well, and just saying, because sometimes it isn't about a plot in a particular scene, but it's an emotional beat of how she's feeling when grandma says, I can't wait to throw you a wedding banquet, but you know, deep down she knows that will probably not happen.
Gotcha.
So, an award-winning director on the A24 project. It's got to feel good. So, Lee, what were your first feelings on The Farewell? When did it sort of hit your radar, and what were your sort of first impressions on walking out of the cinema?
Yeah, I caught this one in its UK kind of release, and I couldn't have been more hyped for it, sort of with the buzz that was coming out of Sundance and Sundance London. It just seemed to be riding sort of a crest of a wave for quite a while. And I think it's just got such an appealing kind of, you know, simple plot line of, you know, we kind of discussed it with Menasha quite a while ago, that, oh, I wonder how this kind of culture kind of works, this Hasidic Jews, and sort of it was very kind of a documentary style insight to a completely different culture, and I came away going, I really learned something today, and not just enjoyed myself, but I learned something. And that's not something you can kind of attribute to A24 films too often. Yes, you can enjoy it, you can be provoked by an emotional reaction, but you often don't come away going, oh, I learned something new today about a different culture. So I thought The Farewell blew me away in terms of this idea that, you know, it's just that simple premise that if you find out you're dying in China and you're of an older age, your children, your family, don't tell you about it, and sort of try and make sure that you have a positive last few months of your life. And that kind of grips you because that's so kind of different to what you would get here in the West. So I was immediately curious to see what this film was going to kind of unfold like, and I loved it. It made me hungry, it made me learn a lot about a different way of life and culture. I thought it was filled with great performances, and it was one of these sort of things that I really love movies where it feels like just a slice of life, and it just was so fun to watch this family's life just sort of unfold over a couple of weeks while they go through such a unique situation. It was a really special movie, and one that I found myself kind of going to see it on a Sunday afternoon to my girlfriend, who wasn't a fan of the film, but I think it was, she's not a fan of some of these indie movies that I like, where she describes them as sort of having, if it's got plinky plonky soundtracks, it's probably not going to be her cup of tea. So she was sort of huffing and puffing while we were watching it, and there was a thing up on Twitter recently where it was like, what film has kind of made you cry the most? And yeah, I cried at The Lion King when I was a little kid. I had a little sniffle when Data died in Star Trek Nemesis, spoilers for that 2001 movie, but for this one I was just like, you know, not once, not twice, but three times during sort of the last stretch of the film, I was being pushed into an emotional position, which I was blown away by. It really left me emotionally compromised, and a really fantastic film from Lulu Wang and everyone involved.
Yeah, emotionally compromised, I like that. Yeah, I mean, I was probably sort of the same sort of, I'd heard the sort of buzz coming out of Sundance and was really looking forward to this. Like, it came out sort of, I think it was at the beginning of September here in the UK. You know, at that point you're sort of heading almost into the London Film Festival and sort of towards the end of your sort of 52 films by women. So, you know, this was going to tick a lot of boxes in the fact that it's directed by a woman. It's a foreign language film for, I think you could argue, yeah, it's a foreign language film. The majority of the film is in Chinese, so therefore it counted, you know, people. It certainly created some confusion in America, if nowhere else, about whether the film was an American film or a Chinese film. It was produced by America, but because it wasn't enough in the American language, therefore it didn't count the Golden Globes. It was obviously wasn't eligible for the Oscar because that is for a foreign language film from another country. It had to be US one. But I mean, what did you make of the sort of decision to basically have the majority of the film in its sort of essentially native dialect?
I was really pleased with that because a movie like this, it could have easily been to sort of have them all speak American, but if you're going to go to a place like this, and especially using sort of, some of these people are actors, you know, they've got a long history, but many of these perhaps background players and one or two of the leads do not have that opportunity to sort of, you know, be fluent English speakers. And I think it kind of grounds it in sort of a realistic kind of world. And, you know, if you're coming from America like some of these characters do, of course you might be kind of speak English very well, but maybe your Chinese perhaps isn't the strongest, you know, after all those years away. So I think it was really good, and I think it was, you know, it grounded it in a reality that could easily have been easy to take you out of. I think, was it Crazy Rich Asians? I've only seen it once, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that was a film where it was predominantly all but in English. You know, maybe it's just, you know, it's banking maybe on sort of a more kind of mainstream crowd being able to see this, the film, than The Farewell, which has maybe sort of got lower margins and sort of expectations for audiences that they're going to hope to eventually get in. So it can go, you know, it can go for those, that niche kind of choices, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that's almost a perfect segue. They sort of mentioned Crazy Rich Asians, and the, you know, this was sort of, these two films certainly sort of showcase that there is an audience out there for films with predominantly Asian casts outside of sort of China, Japan and Central Asia. You know, in Crazy Rich Asians was sort of a huge hit in the US, big hit over here, Farewell, smaller hit, but apparently it did beat Avengers Endgame for the highest screen average of 2019. So therefore, you know, it's a winner in that respect. But I was lucky enough to chat to Katie Smith Wong recently. She is a film writer for the likes of Hey You Guys, Flick Feast, Film Stories magazine. And we chatted about the representation of Asian characters on film, the culture clash between East and West, and many other topics. So hope you enjoy this chat. So, Casey, when was the first time you sort of heard about The Farewell? When did it sort of pop up on your radar?
I was actually following the news about The Farewell from Sundance Film Festival, because it was one of the key films of that year's festival. So when I heard that it was going to be shown as part of Sundance London, I just jumped at the chance to watch and review it, and I am so glad I did, because it's one of my favorite films in the last few years.
Really? It made that much of an impression?
Yeah, because it was just one of those films that was rising along the wave of Asian representation in Hollywood. After Crazy Rich Asians and To All the Boys I Loved Before, The Farewell touched a very small part that related to me, because Billy or Awkwafina's character is a Chinese American, so she lived most of her life in the US. I myself was born and raised in the UK, but both of us seem to have different conceptions on Asian traditions, like a lack of familiarity with it as compared to our parents. So while Crazy Rich Asians and To All the Boys I Loved Before respectively touched the comedic and the romantic side, this touched on the more emotional, personal side of my Asian heritage.
Yeah, because I know you wrote an article for Film Stories magazine about that very topic. I mean, what did it mean for you to sort of 2019 was a sort of, it's sad to say that it was almost waiting until 2019 for it to be a breakthrough year for sort of films featuring predominantly sort of Asian casts.
I mean, yeah, it's one of the things that I'm finding. It's very easy to comment on it now because a lot more people now are increasingly receptive to Asian cinema. If anything, like, you know, to look at Parasite, it took until 2020 for foreign film to win Best Picture at the Oscars. So with The Farewell, it's hard to describe really, because it's a film filmed in China, but it has a very universal message about family and culture, and it's, you don't have to, you know, just be an English speaker to really relate to it. I've read a lot of reactions after people watched it. They had that emotional connection that I had, not just from the cultural side, but that, you know, the relationship with their grandparents or with their family and the culture clash that they've experienced. So yeah, it hit a personal chord for me.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the main issues in the film, is this sort of culture clash between East and West. I mean, even the sort of Academy and Golden Globe sort of didn't really know whether it was an American film or a Chinese film. It was like, it was too Chinese for the Golden Globes, who classed it as a film in the foreign language, but then not American enough apparently for the Oscars, who failed to nominate it for Best Picture, which I think they should have. And the sort of the family side of it, it's a really sort of interesting sort of look at the East versus West, because I know in sort of India is very similar to sort of China in the fact that the sort of older generation will stay, everyone will sort of stay in the same house and they're sort of looked after up until their point of death. But here in the UK and stuff, I mean, we've sort of seen some of the downsides of it at the moment, with sort of once the older generation kind of gets sent off to care homes and stuff like that. So I mean,
yeah,
it was also
really great for Lulu Wang, the director, to kind of relay these themes in her eyes, because I actually attended a Q&A with her at Sundance London, and she was relaying about how she fought to make sure that this film was not cast with Caucasian characters, because that would have changed the narrative and the whole approach to this completely. Not a lot of people, you know, when I sometimes speak to people, not just friends, but people in general, about like cultural aspects, like with regarding Chinese families, it's kind of hard to convey. But with The Farewell, Lulu actually managed to do this quite clearly, so that they can visually see, you know, the conflicts, the ties, and everything that may be hard to describe, but it's easy to visualize.
Yeah, and I mean, I know that you actually interviewed Lulu for Film Stories magazine. I mean, what was that like, getting the chance to speak to her sort of one-on-one?
You know, I was so excited, because it was not the fact that she was an Asian director, but it's the fact that she did The Farewell. It's the fact that we were able to, I was looking forward to being able to ask the kind of things that, you know, like from a personal side, how she was able to fight for things that she needed to convey in The Farewell, and that the aspects that make it so great. You know, it was like, how would Asian audiences react to her story, the structure between the, you know, the relationship between Billy and Nai Nai, her grandma. It was one of those opportunities that don't come that often, especially when it's practically at the start of her career. The Farewell is only her second film, and to be able to interview her before everything, you know, before she won at the Spirit Awards for Best Film, it was just one of those rare opportunities that I'm just grateful for.
I mean, one of the really interesting things was, so when I watched it, I was aware of the basis of the story, but the sort of based on an actual lie. But I mean, it was a real sort of emotional sort of sucker punch. I mean, I know Lee, who co-hosts this podcast with me, he admits that this is the film he's probably cried at the most in the last couple of years. Sort of just the ending of it gets him. I think when they're in the taxi and she's sort of waving them off, and then you can sort of get the kicker at the end that, you know, Nai Nai was actually, you know, still alive. She, you know, she was still doing reasonably well and stuff like that. I mean, that was a huge shock. And I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, were you sort of in floods of tears at the end, or was it that kind of reaction? Or
it was, because I have to admit, I'm not a huge crier when it comes to movies, but this it was not just everything else that The Farewell was about. It's that the fact that it was the relationship with her grandmother, and it was it kind of went back to how I felt with my grandma, who passed away quite a few years ago. But it was the idea that I couldn't actually say goodbye to her. I knew she, you know, one day I found out she was ill. My parents had gone out to fly out to see her, and the next day she had passed away, and it just devastated me. And that seeing The Farewell and how it ended just kind of just brought that back to me. I think that's the, you know, just further emphasized the emotional connection I had with this film.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of the things about it is this, I think there's a lot of people, I think in the interview with Lulu that you did, you sort of talk about the sort of instant reactions that people have to it, about this lie where basically they're not telling Nai Nai that she's got cancer and she's dying and stuff. And there's a lot of people say, oh, well, we would never do that. But I think it's interesting to sort of see that by the end of the film, you can almost sort of see it.
Yeah.
See sort of people sort of change their minds, especially when you find out that Nai Nai had done the same thing to her husband, and that it's just sort of one of those things which is kind of almost accepted in that culture, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's just it goes back to my point, is that, you know, it's hard. If someone were to say to you, oh, we didn't, you know, my parents didn't tell my grandma that she was dying, it's like, well, why not? But then you realize there are other things that go into play. You know, it's like, you know, would they want their grandparents to be constantly worried about their health, or would you want them to be happy? Is that conundrum that goes into play, and that's what makes The Farewell quite balanced in a way. It's not just about, you know, the moral side, but realizing that they don't want to worry Nai Nai. They want to make sure she's happy.
Yeah, it's clearly not just a sort of black and white sort of issue. There's clearly much more sort of texture and shading to it all, isn't there?
Exactly. And I think with, you know, when you come to we think about plots like this, you could either make it an all-out comedy or just make it a really depressing drama. But this is where, you know, the Farewell had a bit of balance, because there was drama, but there's also joy. Nai Nai is seeing all her family there. She wasn't sure if she was going to see them all. And you know, it had the balance that not a lot of people really expected.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, you've got the sort of incredibly sort of sad moments where people sort of reflecting on this, but then, like you see, the sort of wedding sequence where everyone's sort of together and having a good time, but there is sort of emotional moments as one of her sons sort of breaks down during it, and the young boy who's getting married sort of can't almost cope with it. You know, he's sort of almost been thrust in this impossible position that he's been sort of having to rush through the wedding to his girlfriend in order to do this. And of course, then they stitch him up at a drinking game as well. That's actually one thing I was going to ask you, is because like the majority of the film is subtitled, but there are moments where it's not. And I mean, are you familiar with that drinking game that they were playing at the wedding? I was trying to figure out what the rules were that they were basically stitching this one guy up.
I can't actually remember, but there's like, well, I can't remember if this was the game or not, but it's, the idea is that, and sometimes Chinese weddings, you know, you go out to each table and you have the biggest chair and you all have a toast for the bride and groom. I can't exactly remember if it's a game or not. I don't go to that many Chinese weddings, so it's not, I can't really comment on that.
Yeah, no. One thing that struck me was it was a very sort of dressed down affair for a lot of them. There wasn't really the whole, I mean, there certainly wasn't, you know, full kilt outfits and dresses and fascinators and stuff like that. It was a much more sort of relaxed sort of affair. I mean,
I think that's also indicative of how far that this rumour has gone to, because weddings in China are very huge affair. There's a lot of color and richness, and it's quite extravagant, whereas this, it was just a bit like, it was not a it didn't feel like a wedding, it just felt like a fond farewell with someone getting married in it. Which kind of speaks volumes about how far this you know, the situation with Nai Nai has spread. It's not just a family thing. It's a community thing.
Yeah. I mean, we need to sort of talk about Nai Nai and Billy, that sort of central relationship. What did you make of the performances?
I thought they were great. I'm not being biased, honestly. It's because you know, with Awkwafina, she's this bold comedic force. You know, in Ocean's 8 and Crazy Rich Asians, she's really loud and really bold. And here she's quite laid back, and she's allowing Billy to just carry this burden that she didn't want. And she's just, and it allows her to just deliver this very subtle performance. And with Nai Nai, she did this quite, it's almost bittersweet, this chemistry, because it's like, you know, Billy knows, but Nai Nai doesn't know. It doesn't affect their relationship with each other. They still love each other, and Awkwafina was able, to convey this quite nicely. She didn't have to be over dramatic. She just was able to just be quite natural in her delivery. Yeah. And it's complimented Xiao Shenzhen's performance as well.
Yeah. You know, one thing that sort of struck me, sort of, I watched it for the third time sort of recently, and I was wondering, do you think Nai Nai knew? Do you think, because I got that on the third performance, that basically, you know, they're all over here, they're all making a fuss over her. She's been to the hospital several times. Do you think maybe in the back of mind she kind of knows and accepts it, and she's just happy that she's got this chance to spend time with her family again?
Yeah, I think so, because it's not, I don't think in my mind that she would unknowingly worry them. I think she is appreciative of her family, but there will be that idea, that little idea in her head, that when you see them all around the family dining table and they're looking at her with this anxiety etched across their faces, she must have known. But I think a part of, small part of her is just loving the fact that she's the center of attention. You know, she's just, maybe she, you know, that if it came to pass, she would not think twice about maybe milking it for a little bit longer. but that would just kind of destroy the whole mystery of whether she knew or not.
Exactly. Yeah, it's one of those better not left unsaid things, like the end of Lost in Translation. You know, what did Bill Murray whisper to her? Yeah. It's just best if we don't know. It just lets people speculate, I think.
Yeah. And you know what? That, it worked in its favour, because I think a lot of the articles that came after after the Farewell Show in Sundance is like, you know, did the grandma find out? You know, but subsequent later reports kind of start to question that.
Yeah. And so one sort of final question about the film is, did it make you hungry? Because I was very hungry after what, there's a lot of sort of communal eating and stuff like that, and I have to say I was starving by the end of it.
No, the first thing it made me want to do is call my mum, because it just made me, it brought back those emotions with my grandma, and it's like me watching the Pixar short bow. All I just wanted to do afterwards was call my family, because that's the kind of thing it brought out in me. I just wanted to hear my family. Even though I don't contact them that much, shamefully, was the first thing I wanted to do.
It's the kind of film that, yeah, and Bao is just, I loved that short when it was, I just love that one. Yeah, it's such a beautiful one. But I mean, sort of in a broader sense, sort of with A24, I mean, sort of doing the award circuit, Lulu was sort of saying how grateful she was that A24 came in and sort of guaranteed the sort of cinematic release of the film and pushed it into cinemas. She held out. She didn't want to go on to Netflix and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. And they allowed her to just keep her vision the way she wanted it. She didn't want to cash out. She wanted to. I heard that she had gotten quite a lot of, you know, offers, but she didn't feel that any of them was the right one. And A24, I found in recent years, have been great in making these really great, naturally told stories that don't feel exciting or, you know, out extraordinary, but they make them extraordinary. And it's like some of my favorite films, like some great films have been produced by them. It's like The Florida Project, Waves. They're great films. And I don't think they have a certain vision that just would just captivating.
I mean, I'm just sort of know when you sort of first became aware of A24, because obviously in the UK here, they're not a distributor, so therefore they get distributed by all sort of different companies, whether it's Universal or Film 4, Entertainment One, etc. and stuff like that. When did you sort of first become aware of the brand and realise that, you know, like you say, it's like there's all these sort of different films, but there's just something about them that seems to, you can go, oh yeah, because I can see why A24 have produced or distributed that one. There's just something about them, isn't there?
Yeah, I think I think the first film, A24 film I watched was probably Bling Ring, which is Sofia Coppola's film. But I don't think I really paid attention. I didn't really notice them until Moonlight by Barry Jenkins, which was just an outstanding film. I was just it just was so captivating and so mesmerizing. It was just done in a way that was just felt so natural that you didn't feel like you were watching a film. You were just watching a journey. And I think that's one of the integral things that that they've been so great about. It's about telling these journeys that just are so captivating that you just end up being sucked into their world, whether it's, you know, in California, in Bling Ring, or with in Moonlight, or even the Witch. You know, it's stories that just capture you and just suck you right in.
Yeah. Well, so final question for you, I guess, is what would you like to see Lulu Wong do next in her career? Where would you like to see her go with her career?
It's kind of hard to top the farewell, to be honest, because it's such a personal
You think
project.
She should retire then?
Yeah, but you know what? In an ideal world, I think if she were to make a project with Barry Jenkins, that would be so awesome.
Yeah, that was one of the most, but I have to admit, I was completely and utterly shocked when, during the award ceremony thing, that it turned out that they were a couple. I just thought they were like friends who were like supporting each other's projects. When I discovered they were a couple, I was like, my head like was blown. I was like, what? When did you find that?
Yeah, I think I found out. It was just, because they've only been going out for a year or so, haven't they? So it's just a bit, I think it was in the midst of, late last year, yeah. But it was definitely after the farewell. I think there was a lot of stories going on about whether Barry would be in London, and I was like, why? that's why. that kind of feeling.
They're definitely sort of battling, I think, Greta and Noah Baumbach for the A24 power couple. But I think I would give it to them. I think between the Independent Spirit Awards and the Oscar for Best Picture, I think it's probably Barry and Lou.
Oh God! They're an unexpected couple. But when you think about it, I don't think that you could find a better pairing in terms of filmmakers, like in a modern couple kind of sense.
Yeah. Maybe one day we'll get a joint project between the two of them, and then it'll be the greatest film A24 have ever produced, and then everyone will just have to retire at that point because they can't top it.
And then if they don't win any Best Picture rewards, then there'll just be riots everywhere.
Yes. If they don't win, we riot.
Oh yeah, definitely. I'll be leading the petition.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for coming on and talking about the farewell. It's been fantastic to talk to you, and hopefully we'll be able to get you on the A24 project again in the future.
Great, thank you.
So thank you, Katie, for joining us on the A24 project. So, Lee, Katie there was talking about sort of the culture class between each of us, and particularly, you know, we had a chat about the notion of this lie that is maintained throughout the film, and the real sort of differences between East and West culture, because sort of in China, particularly in India as well, I was over there last year, and they look after their old people in the sense that it's very much a family home. Everyone stays at home the whole time. Their families looked after there. Over here in the UK and the US, many of them get shipped off to care homes. And unfortunately, at the moment, we're really seeing some shocking sort of situations that happen when we do that. I mean, how much were you aware of about that sort of culture clash before sort of seeing the film, and you know, how much did it sort of affect you?
I think it's a tricky one in a way, because there was elements that I was aware of, and when I say I was aware of it, maybe I was only aware of it as a potential stereotype, where it was, you know, you see sort of the kind of, you know, China's an interesting kind of country, you know, in terms of what gets out about kind of China. It can be kind of very well controlled, sort of with the restrictions and so on the internet, and sometimes the information that you get is often sometimes given through perhaps a Western lens or perspective. Maybe it's sort of kind of comes at you sort of little bits of this and that from sort of documentaries. But I was kind of aware that sort of they would sort of keep the family unit together, you know, some of the pros and cons of that. But if someone had asked me before seeing the farewell whether that was true or a stereotype, I wouldn't have really been able to give a confident answer. But I think, like as I said, this film sort of gave me sort of a bit more of an insight. And while again it is a film, it is based on a true lie, as it were. You know, Lulu Wang, you know, I've seen the film twice, but I decided for this rewatch to listen to the audio commentary. And while I appreciated that most of this film was drawn from her experiences with her grandmother, how much of it was real, what she'd seen, what her family went through. So while it I'm still maybe not 100% sure about the complete dynamics that kind of China has, perhaps for a majority of their citizens, perhaps their older ones. I do have a good understanding that there's, you know, it certainly is valid. It's maybe not just a stereotype, but, you know, one that Lulu Wang was able to articulate well from her experience.
Yeah, because one of the most interesting things I've thought about the film was, I mean, I didn't know much about this sort of the family sort of situation before going in, not this particular family, but families in general, and sort of quite taking that. And one thing I've sort of found with people watching the film is there's probably sort of, they're quite quick to judge. So certainly Western audiences were quite quick to judge the family, saying that's terrible, you can't do that. I mean, Billy, the main character, sort of says as much there, you know, you need to tell us, you need to know what's going on. And then they're sort of saying it's for her, it's for her benefit, she doesn't have to worry. And then you get this sort of reveal sort of towards the end that the aunt says that, well, Nai Nai did the same thing to her husband, and that it's almost just a given that, you know, if someone becomes ill, they're not told, so they don't have to the stress and the worry about it. And I sort of talked to Katie there in the chat there about it. I mean, so watching, if you've sort of seen it three times now, I'm just keen to get that. I've seen it three times now as well. I'm just keen to know, do you think Nai Nai knew? Do you think she probably had it figured out, given the hospital trips and stuff, and she was going along with it because she was happy that the entire family had come along? Or, I mean, obviously, you know, we're talking about this, but, you know, I don't think it's fair to classify these as spoilers, since it's pretty much the plot of the movie, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I think if you're listening to this, then, you know, if you're not, I'm sure you've maybe checked out for the first time. But I never got the impression that she knew, but I could watch it and probably think that was the case too. I think that's going to maybe colour my next viewing when I get around to eventually. Like,
apologies.
You know, no, not at all. Like, I think it could be one of those ones where you can watch it and go, right, you know, I'm going to watch it, and I'm going to, I suppose it's like when I'm kind of watching 24, like blitzing through that at the moment. And like, you'll sometimes have a plot twist where someone you thought was like really good on your side the whole time, dun, 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 they're actually a terrorist or they're a mole or something like that. And then you'll sometimes go back into the episodes leading up to it going, right, did this actor and the writers actually know? Or was it just like a twist that was kind of thrown in? And so it can kind of sometimes inform you when you watch some of the performances of whether, like, it was, yeah, we want you to act a bit shifty here because there's something going to happen, or, oh, right, let's retroactively add something in. So I think I will kind of, you know, watch it with wondering about that next time. But no, that wasn't an impression I got this time round, but I think it's going to be fun to watch it again.
Yeah, no, I think the most famous one I've heard of like that is probably Harry Potter, and I think J.K. Rowling, she knew the whole story in her head. You know, she, when they started making the film, she hadn't written all the books, but she did know the character of Snape inside out, and she knew that he was, you know, his fate and stuff like that. And apparently she told Alan Rickman going into the series how his character's arc was going to play, so he could play it throughout each film, so you can look back on each film and realise, you know, he's actually playing it. He's playing the long game in that one. So yeah, no, it's always interesting to think about. I mean, I think I rewatched this one just off the back of Inception, and if you've listened to our spoiler heavy chat on that in Filibuster, then you'll know why I'm maybe looking for things that maybe aren't there at this point in time. But sort of going on to the sort of central relationship, you know, it's a family film, but the majority of it is down to the central relationship of Billy and Nai Nai. I mean, what did you make of the two central performances there? Because Awkwafina is an interesting one, because certainly to maybe people in the UK, she's probably best known for the likes of Pitch Perfect, Ocean's 8 and Crazy Rich Asians, where it's very much broad sort of comedic role that she's been put in. What did you make of her sort of dramatic performance here?
Yeah, this was my real first introduction to her. I remembered her from sort of some of the odd bit part, things like Bad Neighbours too, but, you know, I had no real strong impressions of her. I know she's kind of got quite the following before sort of the Farewell, but I really loved watching that performance, because it's impossible to project yourself onto them. Well, for me personally, you know, I've lost three of my grandparents. You know, one I never knew he existed, so kind of, you know, four, you know, by blood, but three through kind of, you know, I would say consider legitimate grandparents and stuff. And yeah, it was kind of one of these ones where you were watching it, and I never really had the big chance to like say goodbye or spend much of the way of time before any of my kind of grandparents had died. You know, there was one where I was going to head up, you know, to see them, but unfortunately they passed away sort of like a few days before I was able to go. The other one, I just lived at the other end of the country at the time, and it just wasn't possible. And then one, I was just sort of too young. And I was sort of just watching it, and you just almost imagine like, well, what happens if I had that chance to go back again? You know, that's one of my great frustrations in my life, that I never maybe got the opportunity that we saw with sort of Awkwafina's character and with Billy to say those goodbyes and to, you know, have a last sort of hurrah, and then sort of have the perhaps happy ending. You know, there might be in the future, obviously with the way the film ends, you know, there might be an opportunity for perhaps another bit of sorrow in the future. But God, it was just like, you thought that would be a great way to spend some time with someone as they were kind of, you know, due to die and stuff like that. And I was just really envious of that relationship and, you know, what Awkwafina and had brought to the role, and sort of Billy, and sort of what Lulu Wang had brought with her writing. And it was just like I was bringing myself in my own way to this kind of experience, and it made me happy, it made me sad, and it made me envious.
Yeah. Did you like Katie, did you phone your parents afterwards? She said she came out of the film and immediately wanted to get in touch and speak to her family. Did it have that effect on you as well?
No, not for me. I had a debate, not an argument, not a negative argument, but an argument about the film with my girlfriend afterwards, where I think like she'd given it like 1 star or something like that, which I know it was ridiculous. And I had given it kind of, I think I'd given it like a 4.5 or a 5. And a few of my friends follow both me and my girlfriend on Letterboxd. And within like a few minutes of us both like leaving our little review on Letterboxd afterwards, like there's a few like going, "What the hell's going on here? Like, what happened?" and stuff like that. So, you know, she's refused to ever watch it again after I dragged it to see this one. So, no, that's how I spent it. How did you sort of spend your time after the film?
I spent it actually rather hungry. I mean, like you say, it's like they're always sort of eating, and the sort of communal sort of family eating is very big. And yeah, I had this, the biggest desire for like dim sum noodle soup and all that sort of stuff. And so, yeah, I probably went home and ordered a Chinese, to be honest, I think.
Yeah, there's a great like Chinese place here in Edinburgh called Chop Chop, which does those ones where it's all the shared food and that. And I love that about kind of like, you know, China, Japan, Korea, that shared element. And when I kind of, you know, I think the closest you probably get to something like that here in the UK is bloody tapas. You know, we don't have a culture of, you know, maybe the odd Sunday dinner where you're passing the roast potatoes or Yorkies around and stuff like that. We just have, I was really envious of that culture of like, you know, that table that spins around so that, you know, everyone can get everything, and you know how they're all sort of looking at each other as they do it. It was just, you know, again, it's just that little thing, so you think what a fantastic culture and how they all interact and look after each other. It was lovely.
Yeah, no, I think sadly I think communal eating, particularly out in public, is potentially a thing of the past given COVID-19. But I mean, that sort of scene in the restaurant was great. I loved the sort of camera work there, where she was basically using the rotating around the table to sort of show everyone and stuff.
If you listen to the audio commentary, they tell you how they did that, so that on it, that they had like, they couldn't get like a proper, there was something wrong with the camera or something like that, so the camera in the middle and the cinematographer was underneath, and then someone had to give, there was like, I think it was like the assistant to her had to get a tap when it was time to like spin it round. So like the director, a cinematographer is underneath like, or moving the camera just as she's getting tapped each time. So it's little things like that where you think that is like, you know, we can think of all these big budgets cameras and, you know, what technology could do, but sometimes it's the old fashioned way of giving someone a little kick when it's time to spin the camera onto the next person.
I love that kind of budget movie making. You know, that's what's missing these days. It's that kind of, you know, okay, we've got a problem, how do we solve it? That kind of DIY, Sam Raimi, Evil Dead 2 style of filmmaking. I love that kind of stuff. And so finally, sort of, I guess, speaking about Lulu Wang, you know, she was very vocal during the award season about how important A24 were to this film. They were committed to giving it a theatrical release. She sort of toured around doing Q&As, sometimes impromptu ones, when her and her friend went to a screening. It was like one of the guys, so she just got up and started doing a Q&A at the end. I think the cinema and the guy in the audience were a bit freaked out as to what was going on. But I mean, what did you make of her as a filmmaker? I mean, she is part of, you know, I didn't realise this until I think about the Independent Film Spirit Awards, that she's actually part of a power couple with Barry Jenkins, you know, up there to rival Greta and Noah Baumbach. So, you know, what would you like to see Lu Wang do next? Would it be another film with A24? Where do you think you see her progressing?
I must say, like, I absolutely love that about Lulu Wang with her, what's it called, where she did these sort of improv Q&As. Like, I saw some footage, like, I think it's up on Twitter or something like that, where it's just like her and like a small crowd, like 3 months into sort of like the screening of the film and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's things like that you think, if I had a film, I would kind of love to do that. Or would I have the confidence to, you know, get up there in front of maybe like a couple people and maybe not feel self-conscious, or, you know, think, oh my God, there's only like two people here, or who knows? I just thought things like that were like adorable, where it's like, when I was watching this for the first time, I hadn't seen any of her previous films and have done since. And yeah, I got all the impression that she had all the enthusiasm of sort of like this first time director. But obviously I was sort of quite ignorant about sort of her filmography before this, and I just thought she came across so well during sort of this, the, you know, the build up to the farewell and sort of the award season. And the film really was done a dirty too. I mean, you know, there's obviously whole different discussions that can be had about A24's budget for, you know, Academy Award campaigns and so on, what goes into it, you know, how they have to focus things. But God, The Farewell was just such a wonderful film, and I really want her, whatever she does next, you know, give her any of the budget, give her whatever she wants to do, and I can't wait to see it. I'm really excited.
Yeah, you've got to give credit to a filmmaker who will do a bartending Q&A during the promotion of her film, because apparently, I think she was a bartender before she moved into filmmaking, and I believe she did one in an LA bar where it was basically you could buy a drink, she'd mix it and then answer a question while she was doing it.
So, what would your question be then, Dallas? I remember when this film, what would your question be?
Oh, don't put me on the spot like that. You see, actually, why don't we wait and let's try and get Lulu on the show, and then we'll have plenty of time to ask her any questions. So Lulu, you know, drinks are on us. You come on, mix them up, and we'll have a chat. I think that'd be great. But I think, yeah, she came across so well in the Oscar campaign, and I really thought that, given the fact that, you know, you could get up to 10 nominees for Best Picture, I really thought The Farewell should have got a nomination, and also she should have been nominated for Best Original Screenplay, if nothing else, because it really was such a wonderful film. And, you know, there was that emotional, not a sucker punch, but almost sort of punchier moment where you realise at the end, when they sort of talk about the fact that Nai Nai, the real Nai Nai, was actually still alive afterwards. And apparently, it's probably in the audio commentary, it's on IMDb trivia, about the fact that when the film got released in China, it was called Don't Tell Her, and basically the plot described it as based on writer director Lulu Wang's real life, where they had to basically fake a wedding because her grandmother had cancer, and she found out that way. That was how she found out. You know, they managed to film the whole movie, you know, over in China, you know, without, you know, revealing the truth, and then she found out when the film came out in China. So quite a remarkable story, but I think they're all still friends.
Yeah, it's really good, isn't it? And it's definitely one of the most uplifting kind of codas that you kind of ever see. And I was just like, you know, I was at such a low at the end of the film, like, you know, tears. And then it's like, here comes the other wave, like, oh my God, she's still alive. And, you know, it was just a magical moment. I think in the audio commentary, they talk about sort of the debate and discussion about doing that. Usually when like the credits kind of kick in, most people go, well, that's us out of here, see you later. Whereas like with this, it's like, no, there's a whole different discussion that kind of unfolds. So yeah, if you can buy The Farewell on DVD or Blu-ray or digital, it's really well worth kind of getting the audio commentary for this film.
Absolutely. And from tears of happiness and sadness to tears of anguish with Midsummer. the second A24 film by writer-director Ari Aster, starring Florence Pugh, Jack Rayner, Will Poulter and William Jackson Harper. Danny and Christian are a young American couple with a relationship that is on the brink of falling apart. After a family tragedy keeps them together, a grieving Danny joins Christian and his friends on a trip of a once-in-a-lifetime festival at midsummer in a remote Swedish community. What begins as a carefree holiday takes a sinister turn when the villagers invite the guests to take part in some disturbing rituals. I think it's fair to say that this is probably one of our most anticipated A24 releases of last year, following on from Hereditary. When did you first hear about it? What were you looking forward to most about it? And did it meet your expectations?
This was one I was really looking forward to. I mean, I had really enjoyed Ari Aster's first film, Hereditary, and I was just sort of real excited about the cast for this one. You know, you have Florence Pugh, who had been sort of growing and growing in the past few years. I think for a lot of people, this was the first film they really discovered her in. You know, I'd sort of loved her in Lady Macbeth. Then she'd sort of kind of continued sort of appearing in little things here and there. And then with sort of Midsummer, it was like, ooh, this is going to be really exciting. It was kind of left field casting, but one that you were very confident in. And I thought it had a really exciting kind of marketing campaign. And I think it was one of the first sort of big releases we sort of were charting. I mean, it makes the podcast feel really old now, where we're sort of charting through the early days of the podcast when it was like untitled Ari Aster film. So there was one of these ones I perhaps had more hype going into it than I traditionally would have for kind of the film. So it was a really exciting moment, and I went to see it as a double bill with In Fabric, which we'll be discussing in sort of the coming months on this podcast as well. So I went to see that, then headed across town to another cinema to see this. I think it got like a preview the night before or something like that. It's like official release. So I went along to see that. So yeah, I was really kind of excited for this film. You know, I think it certainly has its flaws. I think the director's cut is probably the superior version of the film for one big reason for me. But yeah, I think this is a film that is one of these sorts of big breakout films. You know, we talk about it where it's like, oh my God, this was like a huge A24 hit. Kind of only made 46 million at the box office, but that is like, you know, could be $1 billion for like a small indie movie with such a small budget. It was one that seems to have captured people's imagination in terms of artwork, designs, coasters, you know, fancy dress, costumes and so on. You know, this has been a real breakout hit, and one that now it's on things like Amazon Prime here in the UK and the US that is continuing to bring in new audiences.
Absolutely, and if nothing else, it has a lovely sort of subreddit theme of dogs dressed as May Queens. It's a wonderful thing whenever if you look on that on Twitter and stuff like that, people dressing up their dogs as Danny the May Queen. But, you know, this was really highly anticipated for me. I was like, hey, 5-star, instant classic, really looking forward to this. I mean, it's certainly here in the UK, it's unavoidable to talk about Midsummer and describing its plot and not thinking of The Wicker Man, and that being the original Wicker Man, not the remake of The Wicker Man starring Nicolas Cage. However, the remake of The Wicker Man and Midsummer both end up with someone in a bear costume. So, well, not a bear costume, a literal bear, but never mind. This was, I think it really started to hype up. It was counter-programming against, I think it was Spider-Man and Far From Home, I think it was. And the marketing campaign, a lot of it was almost based around Jordan Peele, who saw an early cut and said that this film had some of the most atrociously disturbing imagery he'd ever seen. So, I mean, obviously you're going to be like, oh, what are we going to get? But I almost thought it maybe wasn't as over-the-toply violent as it probably made out. It was one of those horror films that was more sort of insidiously disturbing. It's sort of imagery that stays with you a long time. It's not like jump scares, it's just creeping dread in that sort of hostile style of, oh, Americans go to Europe for a holiday and bad things happen. But I mean, a lot of the success of the film for me sort of come down to sort of Florence Pugh, who had one of the most successful years of a young actress, and probably the most varied year of going from wrestling comedy Fighting With My Family to Midsummer to Little Women. you know, a hell of a run. But, you know, this film, you know, Danny's journey of basically falling into grief and then sort of almost coming, breaking out of this toxic relationship into almost sort of a weird, twisted female empowerment. A lot of that sort of starts with the murder / suicide of her sister, Terry. And Lee, you were lucky enough to speak to Claudia Cini, who plays Danny's sister. It's quite an interesting story behind it, but we're going to talk to her now about what it was like to work on the film.
So then you got approached for sort of the role of Danny's sister, Terry, which really launches Danny on her journey through this film. How did you get approached for that role?
Well, this is a very, very funny story, I think. So one day I was just on the set, and Taylor, he was Ari's assistant, just came to me, and I was like, okay, sure, he will ask me if where is, I don't know, somebody, where can he find the cafe, or should I just bring him a cafe or something? And instead of these questions, he asked me that, hey, how are you doing with acting? And I was like, oh, well, this is the question what I didn't expect it, but, you know, I was kind of shocked. But I just taught him what I've done. So as I just mentioned before, I'm from a very small town. So there I was in the school, like in the drama club member for 8 years. But it's not really like big experience. So I just taught him this, and I was extra, and sometimes I did like a bigger part extra, but nothing special. And also my pronunciation is not good. And I just told him this, and he was like, okay, but you don't have to talk, but you really look like Flo, because I don't know, maybe we just stand next to each other like a few days before. And I know that the actress who was originally casted, she couldn't come because of her theater work. Because at that point they knew that who will play Terry, they need to travel to the US to shoot for a few days. And the originally casted actress couldn't go there. So they needed to find someone else. And it was quite an easy solution for them because, you know, I was all the time on set. And yeah, they thought that we look like each other a little bit. I don't know, maybe. So... yeah, and I was like, okay, why not? It's just a great opportunity. I'm really happy to take it, and I've never been to the US before, so it's gonna be fun, sure. And it was fun. Yeah, it was great fun.
What was it like to shoot that scene? Because it's quite a horrific image in a way that you've been asked to take on. What was it like to prepare for that scene? And when you read it in the script, was it how you visualized it?
Well, you know, one thing that I was wondering about, why she did this to her and to her family, because, you know, it's just so cruel, not only to her, but to everybody in her family, like not even killing yourself. You know, I just tried to find out what could be her reason to do it. And I just pictured, like, as I wrote, as I read the script, that how it looks like, which kind of facial expressions does she use and stuff like this. But actually, when I was there, Ari just told me what to do. And as I said before, it was just so easy to follow him. It's very amazing. For example, there is a scene when we watch the TV. I don't know if you know that scene. Mm-hmm. We are just sitting on a couch with my parents, and I'm very sleepy, and I almost fall asleep. And at one point, I just look to the camera. So he was like talking to me through the whole scene until we were shooting it. And yeah, it was very easy to follow him, like all the instructions. Or for example, the scene when they found me. I mean, the police found me. The makeup lady, Abigail, she was amazing too. It was I'm very happy that I met her. So she just put some mascara on me, and Ari just said that, well, he doesn't think that Terry would use any mascara, because at this stage she's just so depressed that she doesn't care about mascara and makeup. So, you know, as I mentioned, all the details, like these kind of details, and I was like, wow. So he really knew all the character, of course, and he had a reason why he did this or this, and he could explain it. Like, and this is only just a small thing. So, yeah. That scene was not easy though. I was very, very tired, jet lagged. I was not hungry. So I enjoyed my time there so much that I forgot to eat, actually. And Salt Lake City is above the sea level, so it's like different, the air and everything, than here in Budapest. So basically, I just fainted before the scene. And everybody was like, oh my God, eat muffins. And they gave me Coke. They was very cute. So I was well after that, like I needed 15 minutes and I was like, okay. And after we took that scene, which was like, well, I think more than an hour. And if you remember, it's quite a long shot, and I couldn't move and I needed my eyes open. So actually, maybe it seems easy, but it was not. And we did like 10 takes at least. So, but I really liked it. And meanwhile, when we were shooting, I just told myself that, okay, keep going. And it was quite the same when we were shooting the Papa Pia, which is just a Hungarian movie. And I was a stand there. And when they dragged me on the motorboat at the Danube, it's very painful. And you have to be strong, because you needed to pull yourself after the boat, actually. So it was not easy at all, and I remember that I told the same things to me, that okay, keep going, you can do it. So yeah, it was like more than an hour, but I was very happy, and yeah, I'm very grateful that they chose me.
It must be the ultimate compliment to say, hey, you look like Florence Pugh, come along, be our sister, be in our film, travel to America. That must be so surreal.
Yeah, actually, I feel very lucky about that. Yeah.
So, Lee, how was it talking to Terry?
Yeah, it's really good. It's not every day you get to speak to someone that gets a job off the back of sort of bearing a strong resemblance to Florence Pugh. So she was really, really exciting to hear about her kind of work, you know, predominantly obviously behind the scenes. You know, obviously she's worked on things like Midsommar, you know, the upcoming Black Widow film, where she sort of reunites, you know, obviously she's behind the scenes on that one with Florence Pugh again on that. So yeah, she was a really wonderful guest to have on, and sort of a very unique role of sort of having a dual thing of working behind the scenes and also having one of the most critical kind of roles in sort of a film. You know, if Terry doesn't kill herself, then the film doesn't begin that way and sort of potentially end the way it does. So yeah, she plays such a critical role, so it was really good to kind of get the inside scoop on that.
Absolutely, it's such a pivotal role, and it's just such actually little screen time, but you know, she makes such a lasting impact. And you know, there's a horrific image at the beginning, and then you sort of see her in sort of weird twisted dream sequences, and then even sort of superimposed over the trees after Danny wins the May Queen dancing contest as well, something which I didn't notice on first viewing. I had to pick up on a second viewing there. But I mean, the, you know, we talk about the central plot is very sort of Wicker Man-y, as I've said, where these American students go off to Europe for this holiday, and you know, anyone who's ever seen like a horror movie like this knows that most, if not all of them, are not going to make it out of this alive, or it's not going to end well for any of them. But a lot of it comes down to this, the central crux of this toxic relationship between Danny and Christian, which is really well played by Pugh, and to give a lot of credit to Jack Rayner for making Christian such a total dick that you're really sort of anti him to begin with. But the great thing about Ari Aster is that he plays it just about right, that, you know, sometimes you're not really sure who to believe when they're arguing and stuff like that, and who's really in control, because, you know, he'll start off apologising and then it somehow works out that Danny ends up apologising. It really is a fascinating relationship to play out on screen, to leading up to a hugely climactic couple of moments. I mean, what did you make of their on-screen relationship?
This is where I think the director's cut was the superior film. So when I first came out of this film, I didn't think he deserved the fate that he had. I thought he was, as you said, sort of a real dick. But, you know, this is a character that he is drugged. He is, you know, taken advantage of. You know, he is essentially, he is, you know, a victim of rape. And, you know, the fate that he deserved was not that, you know. But with the director's cut, and it still is a somewhat leap for me that he deserves that. You know, I think he is a victim of all of this as well. I can now believe a bit more why Danny makes that decision, and that's one of the key things that I can accept and stuff, even if I think someone like that doesn't deserve that fate for, you know, being an asshole boyfriend, you know, and a real asshole at that, and on top of sort of like stealing people's kind of ideas for like academic papers and so on. You know, with the director's cut, you get more of the scenes about sort of how toxic their relationship is. And I could see why Danny would make that decision. And I think when you've got that confidence at the end to go, you know what, that was a fate that I can imagine she feels is justified, then it makes it a little bit easier for me as an audience member. So it becomes something that's not just why this is a sort of stunning piece of direction, you know, complete fantastic payoff. It's one that I can sort of get fully behind without sort of maybe thinking, right, there's something kind of not quite right here.
When you say it as an audience member, do you mean a man?
Potentially. I think ultimately, you know, I suppose it's all about people's views of justice and so on, that, you know, I've seen, I can't get past that he deserved to burn, you know, for that and stuff like that. I mean, you know, it was a horrible way to go. And I suppose that's always my big fear, is that people would, you know, is the idea of burning to death and so on. And, you know, I think the film has so many interesting things to say and do. And I think it can be a bit of a challenge if it is broken down into sort of like, yes, queen kind of thing about like Danny kind of burning him, really, because I think there is a thing where you see it that sort of he is controlled as much as sort of Danny by sort of what is going on in sort of this, you know, village, in terms of his drink is spiked early on with sort of the period blood, and then sort of, you know, the spiking, the, you know, drugging, sort of the, you know, being set up to essentially be killed and so on. You know, there's no disputing that he gives the eyes to this girl that he eventually has sex with, you know, Maja. But, you know, he is kind of forced into that. I don't think he is a willing participant. And I think having those sorts of discussions about, you know, the characters, and hopefully not putting them into complete sort of like black and white, kind of adds to sort of the tragic nature of the end of the film. You know, if people want to take away, you know, a certain thing, that's not for me to dispute. But for me, I find that makes it a bit more of a richer film of sort of them both as victims, but that's not sort of making his character sort of excusable or taking away some of the many horrible things that he does in the film. And, you know, it's a complicated film, and that's certainly not a complaint at all.
Yeah, well, I think we'll get onto my take on that at the moment. But you've mentioned the sex scene there, the ritualistic sex scene, and another interview that you did recently with Rebecca Johnson, who was part of the not an orgy, but part of the group, let's just say, encouraging Christian to complete the act of coitus. And let's hear from her about what it was like on set at that moment.
I suppose you're part of one of the most unforgettable and quite iconic scenes of the film, and really of 2019, where Christian arrives in this large barn to the sight of a dozen naked women and a willing and ready Maja to have sex with him. What was it like to shoot that scene, and what was the atmosphere like on set? When did it kind of, I imagine when you're sort of reading the script, that's one of the kind of standout scenes. What was it like to then be part of that?
First of all, it was every day of the shooting for 2 months was so incredibly hot. Like, it was so, so warm. And then this scene, particular scene, was shot on the last day. And then the temperature dropped, like, I don't know, it was so cold. And of course, right when you're not wearing any clothes, that's when it gets so, so cold. We were shooting the scene for, I think it must have been 13 hours. We had done so much preparation beforehand. There was a lot with the singing, all the women singing. We had prepared that for a long time. There was a lot of preparation where the cameras would be. I know Ari went through, especially with Maya and Christian, went through exactly what would happen in that scene. So there was just, I think, more preparation for this scene than possibly the dance scene might have been. We prepared a lot for the dance scene as well. But apart from that, this scene was, because it involves, you know, Ari didn't want to do 55 takes because everyone's naked. It's a bit uncomfortable. So the preparation, it was just a lot of preparation done so that we didn't have to do that many takes. And Ari works with like very, very long takes. So you have to know what you're doing. You have to do the same thing every time. And you don't want to be the one messing up the whole scene, so we have to do it again. And in the cold as well, it was just, yeah, I think it was a bit, everyone was a bit nervous to start with, because it is very, I mean, it's an unusual scene as it is. It's very bizarre. And then you are completely naked as well, and it's really, really cold, and there are a lot of people watching. You know, people are going to watch it later on, but there's also a lot of people there in that little barn. And, you know, lots of people have monitors as well. So it's not just the people you see in front of you. You know, there are people outside as well looking. And also, there are a lot of things. The timing has to be right. We had to first all sing. Isabel, Maya had to do her thing of, you know, where to look, how to do this and that, where do my legs go, and it all has to be in the right rhythm and the right timing. And then I approaching Maya as well, kneeling down, everything has to be just for the right timing, like right when the camera is in the perfect spot, then you have to do this and that. So it's not an easy scene. It's a very, very complicated scene, and it doesn't help that you're not wearing any clothes, and it doesn't help that it's freezing. So it took a really, really long time to do, but the atmosphere of the people there and it was just wonderful. I mean, the women there who were there with me and all the crew members and Ari and everyone was so, they were just fantastic. This just fantastic, fantastic crew. Everyone were polite. Everyone were in a good mood. And yeah, we knew we had to be nude, but we didn't know that for 2 months already. So it wasn't the biggest issue. The biggest issue was that we wanted not to do too many takes if we didn't have to. To get it right and to make it look very sort of natural and comfortable and very hoga, that, you know, we're not
we're not ashamed of our bodies, and we all look different. And the atmosphere was actually fantastic. But also, it wasn't a sort of, everyone were very, it wasn't a serious atmosphere, but you didn't, like, no one dared to joke too much, because you don't want to make anyone feel uncomfortable, because it is a very, you know, delicate situation. You don't want to anyone to feel uncomfortable, especially when they're naked. It's interesting that it makes everything so different. But it does.
It's a kind of surreal moment as you begin to serenade and almost become part of this sexual display up close. What was Ari wanting from you in that scene? And I kind of had a look at the script itself, and it brilliantly describes it as Maya looks back at one of the women. It's Ulrika. She smiles tenderly at her. This would be touching if it wasn't so weird. What was kind of Ari like kind of directing you as you kind of become part of this very kind of sexual act? You know, you become almost this third wheel in it.
When I read it, I was just thinking, there's no way I'm doing this. And then I really didn't understand, like, why are all these women here? You know, the feeling that you probably get when you watch it for the first time. That's what I got when I read it the first time. And then I realized I'm in it and I'm doing that. It was also sort of a discussion, and with Maya and Christian as well. How can we do this scene so it won't look... I mean, it's weird. Let's just admit it's weird, like Ari said in the script. But it's also beautiful. And I think we all discussed, like, how do we do this so it will sort of look natural that I just sort of grab her hand? Well, obviously, Maya is looking for my as a mentor or something for her. She's looking for some comfort. And I'm there. And I give her that. And Christian he's finding it a bit strange, as you would. And I think when I'm starting to sing to him as well, it involves entire Horga. So it's not just the three of us anymore, then really it involves the whole village is there with him and with them. And I think the bizarre thing with this scene is that we all, like, it's just Christian who's finding this strange. The rest of us are, like, just getting on with it, you know. We're like, we know what's going to happen. We don't find this strange at all. And it makes it even more bizarre. And the singing is just brilliant. Like, it's the timing of everything is hilarious. Like, it's hilarious. But also, it leaves you with this aftertaste that is so bitter. And because it's like, you're wondering what happened. This wasn't, it's not right. And then still, I can't not laugh, and a lot of people can't stop laughing. But when we were shooting it, I didn't realise it was going to be that funny. And apologies to everyone who do not think it's funny. But I didn't realise, and I think the way they cut it was very clever. And I think the whole film, Midsummer, is brilliant because, now, I think it's brilliant, but because it's got its so many moments that you can barely breathe because it's just so overwhelming and horrible when Danny is screaming and all these things happening to her and to the others. And then you have this humour as well, and these points where you just burst out laughing and you really didn't expect it. And then especially in this scene, you really don't expect that, because a love scene is usually not that funny, and it's not bizarre, and it's not a sort of rape, and then you start laughing in the middle because what is this woman doing singing? And I think they could have cut it in a different way, when it would have been a really horrible scene, and also one of those scenes that you would not been able to breathe, because what are they doing to him? But the way they cut it as well, and the timing of everything, just it's just brilliant. So I was of course a bit worried if like what would it look like, what would the scene be like when you actually watch it on the screen, and how would they have cut it, because you have no idea, you know, you're shooting for so long. And then when I saw it, I'm just really, really proud of it, and I'm really, really happy that I'm in it.
You might be able to shed a bit of light on this, because I am not as cultured as you and not a master of languages, but can you tell us a little bit about the song and the song choice? For me, I listen to that and I find it quite a therapeutic song. It has that very kind of cult kind of vibe. What can you tell us a little bit more about the song and perhaps its meaning?
They are not real words, so I'm not singing in Swedish. So what you hear is the, I don't know, maybe it's a Håga sort of just calming, lullaby or hymn or something like this. So they had just these brilliant composers as well, and one woman, and I'm really sorry if I'm getting any of these names or if I've misunderstood anything, I'm just apologizing beforehand, because, but a woman called Jessica, and I'm pretty sure she did the melody of this one and of a few other songs that were sung, and she'd been inspired by Swedish like folk songs and Nordic songs in general, and this sounds to me, it sounds very Swedish, it sounds very Nordic, and also the song Maya is singing in the beginning, I think is like right in the beginning when you see all the snow and all that, and there's a woman or a girl singing this just beautiful tone. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And I think that's also composed by Jessica. And if it's not, I'm really sorry, but it's brilliant anyway, whoever composed it. So there are lots of these melodies that are, and there are other songs being sung as well, but none of them have, they're not in Swedish, and they are just random words or, they sound a bit Swedish, but they're not. And of course, we rehearsed a lot, making different sounds with our voices as well. As you mentioned, I'm a trained singer, but this was so different for me to sing and to make these, little, I don't know, just tricks with your voice that I haven't done before. And it was brilliant. It was brilliant to explore that too, but everything is down to detail in this film, and they didn't leave anything out. So also the singing has been, we've had like some lessons with where Ari also listened to it and said, I like this, I don't like that, and so that, you know, it would fit his image of what he wanted from all the different scenes.
What were Jack Rayner and Isabel Grill like as scene partners for something like that? Did you sort of build up quite a bond together, kind of working on a scene like that together?
Yeah, absolutely. And they are just they're just amazing. Really are. And Jack has got so much experience in films and done not similar scenes, but at least scenes where he was, love scenes like that before. It was just so helpful. And he was really helping Isabel a lot, but also I was asking him a lot because I've never done anything like it. He was so helpful and such a sweet guy. It was brilliant. And Isabel as well. And it was the best.
When you make you shoot a scene like this, a film like this, and you're kind of in this bubble, you know, it is almost, you're in this own little village. Do you anticipate that when you're shooting a film like this, you know, the end of a 13-hour day, that a scene that you've worked on, play a key role in, will end up being dissected in things like Variety, the New York Times, you know, things going, describing it as sort of the weirdest, craziest sex scene of all time, all these sorts of things, and people really looking for the meaning, the song choices. Do you anticipate that, or does it come as a surprise when it happens?
Well, both yes and no. I didn't anticipate the whole film to be, of course, I should have, because of Ari and because of, like you said, that he had already fans from Hereditary. But of course, we knew this scene is bizarre. It's so special. And I remember, Jack said when I was talking to him and asking for advice about the scene and how to approach it, and he said, "Well, Rebecca, after you've done a scene like this, you don't have to worry about anything, because, you know, nothing will get weirder ever in your career than this scene, you know. You won't do anything more difficult than this scene." So it's really, of course, we knew this is something people will be talking about, this scene, but you don't know if they're going to talk about it in a positive way, as I see it when you say this, like it's the bizarre. So I think that's a positive review of it. So you don't know how people, of course, are gonna like it. But when people say they it made an impact on them, that's very positive to me. That's what we wanted.
Sounds like quite an experience, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, she's got a hell of a voice, and you know, this part in sort of a film, you know, we're lucky to have these two guests on that have kind of got a really unique role within sort of Midsommar, and it was a real pleasure to talk with them. So, you know, you don't have to go too far into our back catalogue to get the full interviews with those two.
Yeah, and so we're going to go on sort of my take on it, and it's an interesting one because, like you say, no one can deny that Christian is certainly manipulated into that position, and even, like you say, drugged towards the end into doing this. And it's seeing this is what tips Danny finally over the edge into almost a sort of catatonic state, but at the same time finding a family again, almost, as all the women sort of surrounding her take on the same sort of primal, guttural crying and sobbing and stuff like that, and then she sort of almost finds something. But the sort of final decision that she makes, I think it's interesting between the differences between the two cuts. And one of the interesting things is that this film got a director's cut, I think, was it maybe sort of 2-3 months after the initial came out? I think it was came out in July, and was it about September when it came out? I think it had like one screening in the UK.
Yeah,
that you missed. You were in London at the time, and you missed it because
I even had
to be
the
a good boyfriend
to see it as well. I know, tough at the top.
Yeah, your girlfriend gave you an interesting ultimatum. It was like she gave you the chance to go and see it, but you said no because it was a test. Because you know you've seen what happens to bad boys.
Exactly.
But because for me, I actually prefer the original cut. I mean, like you say, the director's cut has a few sort of more conversations between the two that makes it slightly more explicit about how manipulative he really is. But because a lot of people were arguing over the end about whether or not she made the decision, or whether or not the Swedish sort of elders did in the end. Maybe she was just physically and mentally unable to make a decision. And, you know, to Christian's benefit, I think he was probably still drugged, that he looked like he wasn't really feeling it when he burned up inside the bear, so that was something. But I think given the extra sort of information about the relationship, it kind of sort of tips the hand that she did make that call. And it's interesting that Ari Aster and Florence Pugh both had a different take on it, where he was like, it's a bit more ambiguous, and she was like, no, I did it, I burned him. Yeah, so that was quite interesting. But the one thing I didn't like about the director's cut was there's a scene with another ritual which is set at night time, and I really appreciate the fact that this first the original cut is basically all set in daylight, which makes what's happening almost more disturbing, is that they get away with all this in broad daylight. I think that was something. It's a bit more discombobulating, I think, for the characters and also for the audience as well. I mean, we've got Chidi from The Good Place, who is definitely in the bad place here. I mean, he's even working on another PhD, so it makes total sense. And you've got sort of Will Poulter, who ends up in a very sort of Texas Chainsaw Massacre sort of situation. Actually, even Joshua's death is very Texas Chainsaw Massacre, so there's a lot of other sort of horror influences here. But I mean, the funny thing about this film is the film's ending, the whole story is given to you at the very beginning with the first image of the film, with this sort of tapestries type drawing of, you know, you've got the murder, the Pied Piper of Pele taking them on this journey, and then, you know, the exact basic place exactly what's going to happen, and especially on the pictures on the walls of the buildings and stuff like that. I mean, I was really looking forward to rewatching this film just to sort of pause on the sort of shots of the artwork and stuff like that, just to see how much detail was put in there. Because I mean, even the bear bit is telegraphed earlier on in the picture as well. I mean, what did you make of the fact that he basically gave away the game away at the beginning?
It's all fine with me because, like, I didn't sort of pick it up at the time. You're sort of, I think there's so much to stimulate, you know, you visually alone in the film. And I'm absolutely desperate for a Midsommar artwork book. I think, like, it has some of the best design work in sort of any A24 film, or even some of the most recent films. You know, you see people give kind of fall over backwards to praise things like Star Wars, like, oh, look at the attention to detail, or there's like a thing like a Mandalorian show just now where it's like takes you behind the scenes of every episode. I'm desperate for, like, a guide or sort of like images of that, because there must be thousands of files out there with like a shot of every single image that goes on there. And I would love to see the people that put all that attention to detail kind of recognized. And, you know, people seem to love, you know, Midsommar as sort of a design film as much as sort of an entertainment one as well. I mean, you know, last week I was really lucky because for ages on eBay I've had it like saved of like, oh, I would really love that Japanese print of sort of the Midsommar poster, it looks stunning. And then just last week, it obviously A24 put up 500 of them, and I was lucky enough to get one. But you watch and you think, oh my god, like, it went within minutes, and there's a huge demand. I mean, there's a huge demand for anything they put up in their shop, fair enough. But you know, their artwork thing, I think the people were so desperate for it and amazed by it. I think, you know, people would love to buy something like that, but, you know, a real coffee table book on Midsommar.
I'd love to see your coffee table if it was opened up to the page of the guy who, you know, he's 72 years old. He has one job to do, which is to jump off a cliff and land on a rock to end his pain quickly. And he misses it. He breaks his leg, and then they have to go, and like some of the guys go, oh, get the mallet, and then they all take a turn smashing the guy's head. And I mean, if you left it open on that page, I think that'd be quite a conversation starter if someone came over.
Yeah, exactly. It's maybe a good thing I'm in a relationship and wouldn't have to sort of perhaps fall over myself to explain that.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, we've sort of discussed quite a lot of filming about whether or not Christian deserved it. I think it's one of those films which is really interesting to sort of people watch afterwards, especially couples coming out of the film to see. I think it was this film and Marriage Story. I mean, if you were in a rocky relationship before, I think seeing that sort of double bill could potentially be the death knell on any relationship. But I mean, in terms of sort of between Hereditary and Midsommar, now that you sort of rewatched both of them a couple of times, where do you sit on that? Because, you know, Ari Aster is a very interesting filmmaker, and I know a few people now who have gone back, and, you know, we did an episode of Filibuster where we looked at the shorts of Ari Aster, and if you think Hereditary and Midsommar are messed up, you know, if you think, talk about, you know, when you talk about the strange thing about the Johnsons, oh lordy. So I mean, which one do you prefer? Is it Midsommar or Hereditary for you?
If you put me on the spot, I'd probably say Midsommar. But, you know, I think they're both, you know, I give the director's cut a 4.5 out of 5, but I would give Hereditary and Midsommar a 4 out of 5. So, you know, it's thin margins between the two, but I think in terms of something that I would rewatch a bit more frequently, probably Midsommar. You know, I've seen Hereditary a few times now. You know, probably the discourse has kind of gone on a bit longer with it, but I think Midsommar would just edge it for me. What about yourself?
I think I'm still a Hereditary guy. I think there's, I think it's a more complete film. I think there's, I probably need to rewatch the director's cut again just to make sure of my decision. But I think, yeah, it's not that I was disappointed with Midsommar, it's just that I think Hereditary affected me more as a film than Midsommar did. I think I was more taken with the style maybe over the substance, but it's nothing to take away from the film, which I think is fantastic. And I do have to ask you, you know, if you had attended that festival, would you have tried to leave? Because it's quite interesting how they keep everyone there with the sort of talk of, but it's our traditions and stuff like that. And there is that kind of thing where if you're on a holiday and like this in a foreign country and someone does something odd, you kind of have to sort of go, oh, okay, well, that's just the way things are there. Would you have stayed, or you would have tried to get the hell out of Dodge?
Probably the reason I would leave, more than their wacky rituals, would probably be what's driving me mad at the moment with these sort of summer mornings. So I'm waking up at like back of 5, sort of 6 o'clock, really early, with like the sun kind of rising. So the idea of spending time in a place where it's like pretty much all daytime, I think would screw with my head so much that I'm like, oh my god, I just need to go. I need somewhere with shutters and such. Like, I think I'd probably struggle with that more than sort of like seeing people jump to their death or putting a rogue pubic hair in my pie.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, it's an odd one because, I mean, one thing which I didn't actually really notice until like the latest rewatch as well is it Simon? Is that his name? The sort of British guy who ends up sort of strung up is actually still alive at the end. His lungs are still going, which is really sort of sick and twisted. But, you know, Pelle is the real sort of villain in all this, I think, because, you know, as much as Christian's, you know, you can see when he gets knocked out with the sort of powder on the face and he falls down, you can see Pelle just in the background in one of the cracks of the wall of that hut. You can see him sort of peering through. And yeah, don't trust foreign exchange students, I think is a lesson here perhaps.
Yeah, he deserves to get burned in a bear.
Yeah, but unfortunately we'll have to wait another 90 odd years for that, sadly enough. it's probably the worst festival of 2019 since Fire Festival.
Absolutely.
But the food looked better. Well, actually, bad cheese sandwich versus a pubic hair pie. It's a tough one. But we're going to be back in 2 weeks, and the film we're going to be looking at then is Skin and Share. But Lee, do you want to quickly tease next week's interview of what people can expect to hear?
Yeah, we talked about the film briefly earlier on, but I'm joined by the writer and director of Menasha, Joshua Z. Weinstein. So yeah, that's a really exciting interview to talk about the film and sort of his opinions on documentary making.
Excellent. So looking forward to that, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks, possibly still in lockdown, but hopefully not burnt alive inside a giant bear. We'll see you soon. Bye bye.